From the boardroom to the shop floor, good business runs on good governance. Join esteemed expert in governance, Dr. Nimrod Mbele, for the next hour as he takes us beyond governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa.
Good evening and welcome to Beyond Governance here at 101.9 High FM. My name is Nimrod Mbele. I am delighted once again to be sharing this space and time with you as we continue to interrogate ideas, policies, and leadership choices shaping our nations. On this platform, I would strongly argue we move beyond the headlines, the sound bites. We ask difficult questions. We test assumptions, and we engage robustly but respectfully with the thinkers, decision makers, and legislators who are influencing South Africa's trajectory. And tonight, I kid not, it's definitely no exceptions. By way of a quick reflection on our previous office episodes, in an event that you could have missed it, I had a privilege of engaging, a governance expert by the name of Sanile Swana, who weighed in on an open letter drafted by Dr. Situma Mahabi concerning claims made by Professor William Gumete on the BEE, and I did promise last that I will engage, I will invite Professor Gumete to come through and share his perspective and on the extent to which, he views the BEE and how it has been interpreted and why has it brought so much a public, interest. So fundamentally, on this particular show, we believe in intellectual fairness. When strong claims are made in public, they deserve scrutiny, as we'll engage with the good prof here, but also deserve an opportunity for a response, which is a response and clarity for a deeper meaning and deeper engagement, of which this is the thrust of our conversation tonight. And for those that missed the conversation last week, Dr. Situma Mahabi, wrote a letter addressed to Wits University, particularly the Wits School of Governance, wherein he specifically raised concern about the institutional accountability and responsible use of academic authority in public discourse. This was his claim essentially. And it is on this basis that I had to request Professor William Gumete to come and share his perspective on this very topical issue. We all know that BEE has attracted a whole lot of issues, and it still continues in the U.S., China. Everyone else is talking about it because they're also quite keen to invest in the country. Anyway, before we get into the gist of this beautiful conversation tonight, I want to thank Simpiwe Mteta for producing the show. I also want to thank Peterson, a young man here who's taking over, Craig Guthrie, who's, I'm told, he's in the Bahamas. And I bet Peterson here is learning quite a lot. I beg your pardon. Last but not least, I want to thank you, the listener, because we often promise to give you insights and observations from the perspective of scholars, from the perspective of entrepreneurs, policymakers, and so on and so forth. I would like you to weigh in on tonight's show. Our SMS line is 061-895-1019. Of course, your thoughts and views are most welcome via my X handle, which is at underscore Dr. Mbele. Prof, good evening, and once again, thank you so much for gracing Beyond Governance with your presence.
No, good evening, and thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Absolutely. Yeah. I could not wait, when I had a chat with you last week. So, no, Nimrod, I'm coming. And by God's grace, you are here. Prof, obviously the context of our conversation tonight is informed by open letter, which I've already alluded to. Quickly, can you take us through the overview of BEE, so that we're able to understand exactly what are the limitations and most importantly, the so what question. And later on our conversation, we'll deal a little bit more on the so what question. How do we move beyond the bottlenecks? How do we move beyond the challenges so that we are able to have it as an instrument that was intended for.
Yeah. No, thank you. Also just want to greet your listeners. Happy, thank you for joining in and listening to the program. After independence of many African countries, introduced empowerment programs. Of course, they didn't call it Black Economic Empowerment, but it was variously called indigenization or even nationalization and so on. So really from Ghana to Nigeria to Zimbabwe. Now, the typical, so two models, really. The first is indigenization model, where firms owned by former colonial settlers or foreign owned were handed over to locals, or shareholding were taken over by, let's call it, the natives and so on. So that's the one model. The second model, some countries, for example, like Tanzania, Algeria, Mozambique, and Tanzania, their empowerment strategy was a little bit different. What they did is they introduced nationalization. So the state took over mining companies, private companies, and so on. So, these are the two different forms of empowerment programs since the end of independence. Now, in a case of on both these two models has mostly failed in Africa. I mean, that's possibly it's one of the reasons why many African countries have not done well. I mean, the first African country became independent in 1847. That was Liberia. You think about it, it's about 54, 55 African countries, depending on who you talk to, but according to the United Nations, there's about 54 African countries recognized. Now, out of the 54 African countries, the first African country became independent in 1847. So, repeat, 1847, and that was Liberia. Now, to think about it, possibly only 6 or 7 African countries actually were successful. Just think about it. 55 African countries. First African country independent in 1847. Only 5 or 6 or 7 max of African countries actually did well. Cape Verde, Mauritius, Botswana, Tunisia, and so on. One of the reasons why many African countries fail is this empowerment programs. As I say, two different approaches, two major different approaches. One is the nationalization, this is in Algeria. I'll give you an example. I mean, in Algeria, after the independence in Algeria, they nationalized previously privately owned companies. Let me just think, I'll just show you just kind of one example in Algeria. With land and farms, for example. So at independence, Algeria was a net exporter of agriculture to Europe and so on. And the failed empowerment scheme, and they went for nationalization as an empowerment, a form of empowerment, so transferring to the states, so not to individuals. It caused such a crisis in Algeria that in the late 90s, Algeria was one of Africa's biggest importer of food. From a net exporter at independence, so where a program can go so wrong. Tanzania also went for the nationalization route as a form of empowerment. In 1980, Tanzania had a commission of inquiry on looking back, and they specifically looked at from land reform as the nationalization, empowerment through taking land and nationalizing land. That commission said the country was in a crisis because of that, a failed because of a failed strategy, and that they have to change course, right? We know what happens in more of our recent times in Zimbabwe. Their model is Zimbabwe is essentially the model that we are copying in South Africa, right? Now, Zimbabwe now is a failed state. I mean, it's a failed state. Somebody must come and tell me otherwise. Let me just go back to Tanzania, for example. During the Tanzania's crisis, during that crisis of Tanzania, which they eventually in 1980 said, look, their economic crisis had to do with their failed empowerment strategy via nationalization. At the time, Tanzania had highest inflation that the world has ever seen. Now, you think about inflation. I mean, we think about inflation when, you know, inflation is recorded. Think about the German inflation after the Second World War and so on. When the consequences of the failed Tanzanian empowerment project was that Tanzania actually experienced the highest price inflation that the world has ever seen in humankind's recorded history. I mean, I have to tell you, Zimbabwe again. Their program, which is like our program, they transferred formerly white-owned property and so on. Zimbabwe, the consequences of Zimbabwe was Zimbabwe then superseded with the highest inflation rate. They actually their inflation was higher than Tanzania. Yeah. I mean, these are terrifying stuff, yeah? So there are three countries, so I've just started, you know, Algeria, yeah. Tanzania. So Algeria had the nationalization, you know, empowerment through nationalization. Tanzania, empowerment via nationalization, crisis in the economies. Yeah. Zimbabwe had empowerment through taking private, private property and private assets and shareholding. Yeah. They also in an economic crisis. Yeah. So I'll take you a bit further back. So prior to that, there was actually a couple of other countries that also pursued. I mean, if you go back to Uganda under Idi Amin, I mean, that really was also empowerment strategy. Mm-hmm. We know what happened afterwards in Uganda. Mm-hmm. I mean, they almost never recovered. They ended up in a civil war. So let me go back again to Algeria. Their economic crisis that was caused over a period in Algeria after they nationalized previously private property and businesses, mm-hmm. and so on. In the early 90s, actually, lead to a civil war, one of Africa's worst civil wars in a country. It ended as a bloodbath and so on. I mean, I started earlier off by saying to you, look, just in one example on agriculture, that they became
the net importer,
were exporter.
Absolutely.
And so on. Yeah. So Uganda, you know what happened there. You know, Nigeria also, that people often forgot, also did indigenization and so on. And for those, if your listeners who want to follow up, I did in the 90s, and you can Google it. I did a special report for the Economist Intelligence Unit in London. On the history of empowerment. I mean, it's online. It's the Economist Intelligence Unit every year comes up with quarterly reports where they dive into one specific issue. They do a historical, looking back historically to the present. So I did a report on the history of economic empowerment in Africa since the end of colonialism. So that was done in the early 2000s.
Okay.
And for others who are also interested, I did a second report, also during that period, for the Economist Intelligence Unit. Again, this is a public report on empowerment in South Africa, the state of empowerment in South Africa. So just from a historical background, I mean, the Turks reports, which was obviously very, very controversial one. So the United, the UNDP, the United Nations Development Programme, in 1999, 2000, came up with the first development report on South Africa. For those old enough, remember, you know, that report came out in 2000. And it was the first time in a South African context where locals, that the UNDP have country development reports. It was the first time that a report was done on South Africa in the post-apartheid era. And it was also the first time that a UNDP report was put together by locals. Now, normally these reports are often put together, these country reports, by outsiders. And I did empowerment, policymaking, and so on. Now, if you go back during that time, sadly, with that report, President Thabo Mbeki rejected that report. And then the UNDP, after that, never came up with another development report on South Africa. I mean, it was an absolutely big controversy ahead of the 2004 election. So President Thabo Mbeki rejected the report because the report was critical of the new government. Again, for your readers, sorry, for your listeners, again, just to can Google, can go back to you know, the UNDP. There was the first UNDP report in South Africa, in the post-apartheid South Africa. You know, the chief economist on that report was Dr. Asghar Adel-Sadeh on that report. So it's a public report, came out in 2000, and so on. And I looked at the policy aspects of the then new, new ANC, ANC government, right?
Christoph, maybe let's just hold on for now, because you've really given us a food for thought in terms of the trajectory of empowerment schemes, so to speak, via a policy. Mm-hmm. You've said to us there was indigenization approach, there was also nationalization approach. So these models are actually help us to understand much more broadly on what are the approaches which post-colonial Africa went through, and to the extent to which these models ended up, like Algeria, for an example, was, as you have correctly pointed out, used to be a net importer, a net exporter of agricultural product, and it became a net importer.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
Algeria, and so on and so forth. So I think this is quite useful. We're going to take a break. When we come back, welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Mbele.
Get a little much more join us in the company of one and only
Professor Willem Kumete, Dr. Mhapi is saying, and I want you to take it up,
and he's giving us his perspective
confidence on how you respond to the challenges.
We'll be back in a second.
BEE. Before we went to that particular break, Professor Willem gave us an overview of models around empowerment scheme via policy. He took us through, the nationalization approach, which countries like such as Mozambique pursue and Angola pursue. He also took us through the indigenization approach, which a country such as Zimbabwe took, and we all know what actually happened. Prof, before we took that break, you wanted to share with us a little bit more on what actually happened along the way and why these models failed, because in your assertion you claim that these models completely failed. Take us through that, please.
No, thank you for that. I think there's a couple of reasons why the empowerment schemes in these both of these two models failed, right? I'm going to be very, very specific. If you think, let's just take Ghana, Nigeria, and Zimbabwe, for example. So what I did was they took the firms, let's say the firms that were foreign-owned or owned by colonial settlers and so on, handed it over to the locals, okay. But then what I did was, in Zimbabwe, for example, they transferred to the liberation movement leaders, right? So that is the first thing. So they did not transfer it to locals who were business people. They transferred it to locals who were politicians who then become business people through economic empowerment. Right, that's the first flaw. And why is that a flaw? I just about to come up with a book, and it's already on Amazon. It's Random House, Penguin Random House, is on why did the East Asian medical economies, why did they do it so well? And when I say East Asian medical economies, this is, you know, your Singapore,
Malaysia,
Japan,
yeah.
South Korea, and Taiwan. Mm. Why did they do very well? Now, yeah, is the thing what they did is they empowered people that are already business people that have skin in the game, because you know to be an entrepreneur. So what? The reason why these sort of empowerment programs in the rest of Africa and yet home in South Africa failed is by trying to empower the majority of people who were not business people before, who were politicians, and turning politicians into business people, like making politicians political capitalists. Now, think about entrepreneurship. I mean, entrepreneurship, you have to have skin in the game, and you fail, and many, many people, you fail hard, and you lose
several times.
And several times.
And you still come back.
Yeah, and that is what makes an entrepreneur. A political economist who's never run anything before. Mm-hmm. And think about our politicians, our liberation politicians, and it's typical in other African countries also, is often people who've never run a business, not even a spaza shop, and so on. And perhaps even not even as professionals before, you know, professional business. And now you empower that person to now run a sophisticated business and be an entrepreneur. And that is the one reason for failure. Now, if you go in, for example, in Southeast Asia, in the medical economies, what we now call the medical economies, what they did there, and it was a very, very important point, is they try to empower individuals in the society who already had skin in the game in business. So you already proven yourself as a business person. So then you get policy loans, you get protection from the state, from foreign competition for a period, in order to move. But the second thing what they did in those societies, and coming back, is they focus, they prioritize industries that those countries did not have and that the world needs. Okay, very, very important. In our case, if you look at our empowerment, so the first part of empowerment, it was skewed towards politicians, mm-hmm. right? Former ANC politicians or trade unionists and so on, right? That's the first. The second part of it is empowerment, where you take a private business that's already existing and then you transfer shares to an existing business, right? Southeast Asia, what it did was to say you get empowered or supported by the state, easy finance, they called it policy loans in countries like Japan, is when you create a whole new industry that did not exist before. And an industry that a country needs and that the world needs. I mean, I did for your listeners, in 2014, I was commissioned to do a report on South Korea by the African Development Bank. African Development Bank commissioned me, as they say, look, write us a report on why did South Korea did so well and other African countries failed. And if you think about it, South Korea, by the time of independence, the 1960s, 1950s, 1970s, was poorer than most African countries. Mm. Poorer than most African countries. Poorer than, yeah. So why did they, within 30 years, become such a powerful economy, right? Again, for your listeners, they can Google. The report is public. And a key part of the reason why South Korea did so well is, again, they identified economic sectors that they did not have at the time, and then they said, well, how do we support locals to get into those sectors? But we support the locals who already have business skills, not someone who's a politician or somebody that you pick up from the street and say, now we're going to make you an entrepreneur. Here's some funding. No. Or somebody working in government, you know, DG in government says, now we're going to make you an entrepreneur.
Which is impossible. But I think these examples, Prof, are quite useful. And one begin to see the challenges in the implementation. What I'm picking up from our conversation so now is that, you know, the problem wasn't so much of the design of a policy because it is premised on redress.
Mm-hmm.
The problem has been its implementation.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that we make that distinction that, you know, BEE, you know, principally, it has been a correct instrument for social justice. However, it was captured or abused by those who obviously had different intentions, and that is why we're not talking of broad bait. We're talking narrow. You know, one of the issues that perhaps maybe could just share with you know the listeners, you know, what would you say that around, you know, how has the BES that's been implemented, you know, reinforced elite enrichment enrichment rather than broad based empowerment. Can you take us through that line of thinking?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I actually wanted to make an argument for why empowerment is important. I mean, I didn't start with that because I wanted to give you an overview.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to come to that because I really want to make that case.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just one thing that I wanted to add, which I overlooked. There's actually a certain example of in the African context after the end of colonialism of empowerment. A third example, although it's an isolated example, but it's still very useful, is in Egypt.
Mm.
So what Egypt did is create military companies. So transferring some assets or starting companies and then transferring it to the military, so the military running the companies. I mean, to some extent, of course, in Zimbabwe, part of their empowerment has been they've been handing over private sector shares and companies also to their former military leaders and so on, partially, and then for their political leaders. But in Egypt, actually, they went all of the way out to create, you actually in Egypt have military-run companies, which is quite extraordinary. So I think it is a point one has to
point that out. Would that be similar to what we heard, Danelle?
No. Now we're talking about almost, so when I said nationalization in an Algeria or in a Tanzania, they almost have the militarization of companies. And so on. Now, all of these different, and I'm going to come why empowerment is important, right? All of these examples I gave you failed in terms of because they empowered a few, and then they crashed the economies of those countries, and then they increased poverty. So good intentions at the beginning. Empowered just a few people were absolutely very often, most of them no experience. I mean, if we say Egypt, the military runs a company, Tanzania, you get the state, your political cadres running a company, and you know, many of them were in the bush before, so don't have their kind of experience. So then what happens was it's an elite capture, really, it's of empowerment. Now let me give you the the BEE rationale, why in the SA context, given now the background, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in society like our society, post-colonial and so on, and post-apartheid, what is important is, what is critical in a society, two things need to happen to stabilize a society like this. Firstly, you need to, when there was official racial discrimination, right, and in a way in our country, a country needs to build a middle class as quickly as possible, and indigenous, so middle class from the previously disadvantaged community. So that's very, very important. You know, you can't run around that, yeah? That's the first. And the second thing is to create a business class also, right? It's, when I say business class, the indigenous people, or rather, let me rephrase it in our code, because we are a special type South Africa, colonialism of a special type, because South Africa's colonialism is different to many other African countries. You know, our colonialism is the same as in Brazil and so on, where many of the previous settlers stayed, and then there was intermixing, and so on. And so that's a different kind of colonialism. So we are the New World colonialism, which is slightly different to sort of from the African colonialism. It's a later stage. We are the New World, and the New World colonialism was where your colonial powers came in, they embedded themselves, they lived here, they stayed here. So even when there was an exit, there was local population, and then there was intermixing also at the same time, right? So now our dynamic is a little bit more sophisticated, right? Policies have to be a little bit more imaginative. There's no black and white in simple terms anymore, right? It means now an imagination, a maturity.
Around building the business class.
So on, because now you have a diverse, previously disadvantaged communities that all have to be brought together. So, 1994 in a South African context. Let's get home. So from that transition from apartheid to democracy, we needed to expand. The previously disadvantaged communities' participation in politics, because they were, we were all excluded of politics during the apartheid and colonial era. So for freedom, there needed to be now. We needed to be brought back into the politics. Yeah? But the second thing we needed to do is participate in the economy, because during the colonialism and apartheid, previously disadvantaged people were excluded. So that's important. So when I say the economy, it's the economy, it's markets, it's industry, it's assets, it is poverty. It is property also. That's what a modern economy is. And we know also in a modern economy, what is an economy in our modern times? Mm-hmm. It's education and technology. And so on. So when I say it's a participation in the economy, it's not just the markets and industry, but it's human capital assets. Mm-hmm. The best education in the world, because that transformed access to technology. But it was also critical for South Africa. What we needed to do was to build a black middle class. And that's why affirmative action in the state and the private sector was very, very important, because not having the middle class in a country actually is the bedrock of stability in a country. And one reason why many African countries have failed is that they did not build a black middle class, post-colonial middle class, not a big enough. It was too narrow. So a very, very important part of stability of a country is to build a broad-based middle class as quickly as possible. Now, the other one is to build, in a modern economy, also a broad-based private sector. And then again, if you look at the failure of many African countries, is that we have been unable since the end of colonialism, since Liberia became the first African country in 1847 to become independent, that many African countries did not build a private sector, indigenous private sector, right? So that is why empowerment is quite important for these two objectives, because these are critical objectives for the stability of a country.
Okay. On that note, Prof, just hold it. We're going to have a quick break. Mm-hmm. When you come back, we will go back to why is it that most African countries, especially South, it would be useful to know where South Africa is.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
We juxtapose that with highest unemployment rate that exists. We'll be back in a second. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, I'm having an interesting conversation with the one and only Professor William Kumete from Vets School of Governance. He's sharing with us his perspective around broad-based economic empowerment. And earlier on, he sort of shared with us the different models of empowerment which actually failed. Before we took that short break, he said, he sort of indicated to us that the two critical things that any system needs to do. One is that there's a need to build a middle class, which has been a biggest failure in most African countries because they've got a very narrow or small middle class. The second issue that he brought to attention is a need to build a business class. And obviously in the South African context, majority of black people were on the periphery. Okay, and there's a need. And the third point that he brought to us is that there's a need to broaden up the private sector. So if you have these three variables, according to Prof, we're more likely to get South Africa where it should be.
Yeah. So I just have to add, it's also a capable state.
Yeah.
So, capable state is a very important part of empowerment because you can't empower a previously disadvantaged community without a capable state. Go back to the success, to the economic, medical economies of Southeast Asia. At the heart of that was a capable state. That's almost the first thing. Before you do anything, you try to get a capable state going because a capable state will deliver you many of things. It will intelligently deliver you the policies. It will give you the public services, the good education, the good health, and so on, in order to give you the environment.
Yeah. Interestingly, Prof, if I can just quickly interject. Yeah. Interestingly, I agree that capable state, the NDP speak about the need to have a capable state.
Mm-hmm.
That is a cushion from politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Where did we go wrong? And because we hear of the renewal, doctrine from time to time, but we don't see that renewal anywhere. There's a new reform around professionalization of the state or professionalization of the public sector. These are not new things, Prof.
Absolutely.
And why are we always going back, and creating unnecessary hype when you know that we're not really addressing the real cause? We are addressing the symptoms. Yes, there are issues around capabilities of some individuals within some ministries. We have heard so much about cadre deployment.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard about people that were deployed without merit, people that were been deployed in key strategic positions without business acumen or administrative acumen. We've got all those issues, and those issues came through a number of reports. Zonda Commission report spelled that out very clearly on why we are where we are. But, coming back to BEE, of course, which is also one of the biggest issues that is very controversial. Why is it that we're failing to address the cause, but we're very quick to address the symptoms?
So let me come back to you. So what is often forgotten in empowerment, actually that's a key part of empowerment. And I'm talking this way because I'm broadening now what should be economic empowerment, right? So because our focus, sadly, in South Africa, but also focus in most of these post-colonial African countries, is to focus on empowerment in the sort of business sector. But empowerment, you can't have empowerment if you don't get a capable state. Now, let me talk a little bit about a capable state. I work and I wrote the document, again, one of the base documents for the National Planning Commission, right? On the state itself. Again, for your readers, you can Google it and they can look at the references of the base documents on the state itself, right? Secondly, in 2012, I also co-founded and co-wrote South Africa's first post-1994 development report that was done not by an external actor. It was not done by the UNDP. It was done by the South African government. It was done by the Development Bank of Southern Africa. Now, I said earlier when I started off, I was part of the first post-1994, post-apartheid assessment of the state of the economy. And that was a UNDP report. It was an outside report. They employed us. Of course, local, a combination of locals and a combination of externals, right? Back now, 2014, I was one of the co-founders of the South African Development Report, which was the first time a South African owned. And by the way, it was actually one of the, it was unique because in developing countries often, sadly, locals and the local states almost never do their own audit of their own development. It's always external actors, World Bank, IMF. Others were doing it. Yeah, so that was quite significant, right? I wrote of that report, wrote the state capability, the state capacity part of it, orders of state capacity in that report, right? Again, this is a public report, is a South African government report for your listeners to go back and have a look at that report. I mean, it's sad that there hasn't been a follow-up on that report because that report was uniquely, it was a South African government report in a context of, you know, in developing countries and African countries, they really come up with their own development reports. They always get external actors to do that. Now, a very, very big part of that was the capacity of the state. You know, a country can't do development, can't do empowerment.
But based on the reports that have written, yeah. Prof, what are the practical solutions that you have put forward to get to a point where a state is capable,
absolutely,
in terms of technical know-how, mm-hmm. which not only at policy design but also implementation, absolutely. Because we lack with implementation. What are the suggestions that you put forward together with some of your colleagues, mm-hmm. and why those suggestions or recommendation on how we create a capable state that, in your view, can deliver and all the things that we wanted? What went wrong? Absolutely. What happened?
Yeah. So it's just before I get there, just, you know, I was part of the professionalization inquiry. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a member of the recent one also. So now you have to see, I was part of the state capacity report, mm-hmm. of the development report, mm-hmm. 2011, 2012, 2014. And part of the 2020 mm-hmm. professionalization report. Mm-hmm. So orders of the state itself. Mm-hmm. Now, why? What were our recommendations? Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing in this is, and I'm going to use the economic, medical economies, but I can use any other economy, but I'll use it because it's a very, very useful. Mm-hmm. And I am coming out with a book, mm-hmm. Which, your listeners can already order. Mm-hmm. It's called Radical Economic Transformation. Penguin, Random House, Why Did the East Asian Medical Economies Do So Well in Other Developing Countries Fail? Now, the big part of it is they build a capable state. How did they build a capable state, mm-hmm. right? The first thing that they did was immediately to introduce merit-based appointments. Yep. Like immediately, mm-hmm. right? Now, it is not only them, but if you look at all of the great economic transformations, mm-hmm. right? Germany after the after the Second World War, totally destroyed. What was at the beginning of that? They rebuilt the state on a merit-based state. Mm-hmm. The Scandinavian model of democratic welfare states, what was it? Merit-based program. In Africa, the African success stories, because, you know, it's not all, there was success stories. Mauritius, what they did, they introduced a merit-based post-independence public service. Or they try, I mean, it's not perfect, but they did. Botswana did the same. And you can see the difference. Cape Verde,
quite Rwanda is doing the same.
And Rwanda, absolutely, mm-hmm. Rwanda. And that is, can you see the difference? Yeah. So immediately. So yeah, we've been debating about cadre deployment. The moment you bring in cadre deployment, you kill off your capable state. There is absolutely no way you have an ESCOM and a Transnet, then you appoint a political person where their only equity is their struggle credentials or their ability to be a party member to maneuver at a branch level, And that skill set, you then make them a CEO of an entity. You'll class that entity. And that is exactly what has happened in our context, right? So that's the first part of it, right? Even we take China, which is another example. Every year in China, every year, if you matric our equivalent of our matric students, to enter the public service, there's an exam that everyone writes. Hundreds of thousands of people, they only take the top to enter the public service. Think about it. South Korea and Singapore, you think about our matric results, the only the people who are in the top 100 will get into the public service. That is the seriousness of building state capability. There's no way out of there. You know, there's no middle way. There's no cadre deployment. That's the way that you have to build. And I know a lot of people do say to me, but look, listen here. Our history of marginalization, of previously disadvantaged community, how do we do merit-based in our system? I mean, that's the first thing that people say. You know, you can have merit-based within a system of redress, where you, for example, you pick the best people among the black community to run enterprises, or the best business people, and you support them.
Assumption that there's political will, but let's take a break because we're grabbing.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Dumbede on 101.9 High FM.
Let's quickly take a break. We'll be back in a second. Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. It's amazing how time flies when you really have interesting conversation. I'm here with Professor William Gumete, who's attached to Vet School of Governance. He's giving us his perspective on the black economic empowerment. Before he took that break, he really gave us some insights on aspects such as, you know, first and foremost, we need to have a developmental state. And one of the critical ingredients of having a developmental state or capable state, not a development, but a capable state that drives development, it is that of meritocracy, you know. And he made a very important point that in other places such as China, for anybody to be part of state bureaucracy, they have to go through an exams. It's not every single person that. So we're very far from away from that. And the issue that I've also said, Prof, you've been part of the furniture. We have been set in this commission, that study. But all these things that you've been part of, none of them appears to have been implemented, which means there isn't political will. And if there's no political will, no wonder why our unemployment is north of 40%. No wonder why, when you're looking at our cities, are not responsive, to the crashes that we're sitting in. What is going on?
You know, you're absolutely right. It's political. You know, it's political world. All of these countries, all of these success stories, whether it is Japan after the Second World War, or Botswana, or Mauritius, or Germany, or Brazil, is political world to drive a transformation program. You have to have the political world. So when I say political world, we can unpack what it means by that, to say not to empower an elite, but to empower the widest number of citizens. No matter the ethnic group or whatever, or the color you want, and so on, and the quickest time. What I also wanted to talk to you, just in terms of, I mean, if you just think of that political world, I'll just give you, 2009, for example, I was the chief advisor to the Presidential Review Committee on State-Owned Enterprises, 2009, right? I just came back after quite a while abroad, teaching at Oxford University and teaching at LSE. Came home, and that was one of the first assignments I got from the state. And to look, and what I did as part of that assignment was to audit, to find state-owned entities in the country and actually audit it and define it, and then put a number on how many state-owned entities were there. And the interesting thing, so we're talking about 2009. Now, prior to that, there was, at the time, not even a proper audit of state-owned entities since 1994. So it must also tell you some kind of political will also in a different. Now, in that report, my recommendations, for example, let's think about example, was first recommendation was, look, create a holding company for state-owned entities. Right. So taking the state-owned entities out of the government, out of these government departments, create a holding company.
The Singaporean model.
Absolutely, yeah. The Temasek model. Yeah. Now, 2009, have you seen it? Remember, this is that report was adopted by cabinet.
2009.
Yes, 2009.
And nothing has happened.
Nothing has happened. Yeah, even when I said to you on a professionalization of the public service report. All right, so that report, we started working on it in 2020. None of those recommendations. What we actually tactically proposed and said, look. In our politics, ANC at the time was a dominant party. We accept pragmatically to immediately introduce merit-based system in the public service, there's going to be a revolt and opposition, right? But we can introduce it at economically critical departments and state-owned enterprises, you know, your infrastructure, your ESCOM, your Transnets, you know, your treasuries, your let's call it your critical infrastructure departments. That's a way in. Right? Because, and even that, to do it that way would not actually even be extraordinary because, again, in that report, in that 2009 state-owned report, which I did for cabinet, I use an example, actually quite a wonderful example, a Chinese example. Now, we think about the Chinese, we say, well, you know, they've got Rolls-Royce state-owned companies, you know, global state-owned, powerful state-owned companies. But actually, what they do is they actually have a two-tier system of state-owned companies. They've got one tier, which is critical state-owned companies. There's merit-based accountability and so on. And then they've got a lower tier. They say, well, it could be corrupt and it could go on. But occasionally, what they would do with those, they will just target randomly an entity and then just send people to the guillotine. Yeah. No, to the guillotine, but you know, execution, jail, and so on. So, in a way, so I mean, it'd be coming back to that political world that, I mean, and I can tell you almost in all the inquiries I have been, and obviously I'm grateful that you know that I have been asked to be part of inquiries, despite the fact that I'm often critical of government. So that also says something about the ANC, you know, that there's been space to bring critics on.
Absolutely. Our parting shot, because we've run out of time, literally, Prof. What about, you know, what is the proposed model for BE? Because our conversation obviously started from that end. Obviously, there's been misallocation of capital based on your assessment, and then therein there lies opportunity cost. What is an alternative, and how soon can we get it off the ground?
Yeah, you know, we need to get an alternative because what is happening now is we've got significant numbers of South Africans who are opposed to it. People often ask, why are we getting the implementation wrong? Why does the state get implementation wrong? I think that because there's been a misunderstanding of what implementation is all about. I mean, I've been teaching a course about how do you implement? How does a state implement? So a state, in a democratic state, implements, you don't implement by sending a dictator down, sending the president sending out an instruction. That's not how implementation works. Maybe that implementation is working in China that way and the old Soviet Union. But in no other country does it work. So implementation is stakeholder-driven. So who are the stakeholders? You have to get business, you have to get civil society, you have to get communities, you have to get your civil servants, you have to, so you need to buy in to get implementation. Now, if we've reached a point right now where BE, there's white South Africans who are resentful, there are black South Africans who are resentful. Meaning, unless there's a change of the policy, it's going to be opposed. Whatever it is, so we have no choice to change it. We have to change it. So, what do we need to do? I think the first thing that we absolutely need to do is to say alternative to BE, right? Take out the codes and all of these sort of things. Say alternative. We have to say, we're in an economic crisis right now. We have a high unemployment rate. We then must allow businesses that in lieu of empowerment, so alternative empowerment would be to employ young black South Africans who are unemployed. So if a company, for example, employ 1,000 young people in proper jobs, that is empowerment. The second one, in terms of alternative, is to say small business, so move out of the ownership way, out of the big, big business ownership model. We bring it into small business, because I don't think people understand that in all of these growth economies, whether it is developed countries or developing countries, it's small business. Small business produces, at least in these high growth economies, over 80% of the jobs. And that's what we must go. I mean, we're sitting here below 50%. So we need to get at that level. And the only way that we can get at level is to say, how do we empower Black South Africans to have businesses, small businesses, not big businesses? Mm. So take that money and do this. Then the third thing is, in terms of the model change, is to say, why am I sitting here next to you is education. You know, grow up in informal settlements, poverty. What was the differentiate? Key was quality education. So when you say quality, proper education. You get quality education that you can compete in another market, in another country, right? Whether in the West or in the East or wherever you want to go to. Now we need to, can we get, for example, business to take control of every Black school, towns of school, and adopt them, pay the teachers the salaries, teach the mathematics, teach the sciences, and that becomes BEE, and so on. Say, for example, Starlink comes here, and we say, well, actually, you're a tech company. Can you take the whole of Alexandra and the whole of Soweto, all of those schools? You are actually going to introduce from primary school to high school STEM, science, mathematics, engineering, technology, and you can pay for it, and you can pay for the teachers, and even pay for the kids. Because those things have happened in other countries. So we won't be inventing the wheel.
You know, Prof, unfortunately, we're gonna have to leave it here. But you and I need to have a follow-up, because I'm loving the line of thought, which is an unorthodox, particularly around what are the alternatives, and that needs to be tested. We're going to have to leave it here. Yeah. Thank you so much for gracing Beyond Governance with your presence.
No, thank you for having me. You know, it went so fast. You know, I feel I've only touched on things. But I'm looking forward. We'll do a second and a third one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There you are. That's Professor William Gumete, who's attached to Vets Business School, School of Governance, I beg your pardon, and giving us very interesting insights and thoughts around very complex issues around empowerment. And the last part of our conversation was really about what is an alternative to BEE from where he's sitting. Mm-hmm. And he has brought some very interesting a line of thoughts which require a bit of synthesis, bit of interrogation, so that perhaps maybe they might influence a policy moving forward, because with unemployment rate that is sitting north of 40%, it's not sustainable. We are on the brink of a disaster. So it is important that we take into account these new ones are thinking, even if they go against the status quo. It is important to challenge that, and also very important to really look at how you beef up the capacity of state and how you bring capable individuals based on meritocracy, and how you change organizational culture. Those are some of the big ticket items that I'm pulling from from our conversation. We're going to have to leave it. It's been absolutely beautiful. You promise you're going to come back, Prof?
I am coming back to our second installment, absolutely.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated. Shalom. Okay. Have yourself a wonderful day.
God bless.